Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Why are voters in Tennessee taking up the question of how judges are elected? We'll take that up.
But first, there are just 5 days left until the midterm elections, with all 435 House seats up for grabs, a number of gubernatorial races around the country, and of course, control of the U.S. Senate hanging in the balance. The latest from Real Clear Politics shows 9 Senate seats in the toss-up column. Republicans need to net 6 seats to take control in the Senate. And in our weekly Senate Tracker series, we have profiled all of those toss-ups. You can listen to those conversations at hereandnow.org. But we want to turn now to a race that's actually looking good for Democrats, and it is an open seat. It's in Michigan, where Republican Terry Lindland and Democratic Congressman Gary Peters are vying to fill the seat being vacated by retiring Democratic Senator Carl Levin. Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He joins us now. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, Carl Levin is a well-known figure, not just in Michigan, but all across this country. He's been around for a very long time and been in the Senate and has risen up to leadership positions. Mm-hmm. Big shoes to fill in Michigan.
Yeah, indeed. You know, that Carl Levin is chair of the Armed Services Committee, also the Senate Investigation Subcommittee, and he's used both of those to great effect. Although I'll point out that Levin is really, as you pointed out, a national figure. And Levin certainly was a big advocate for the auto industry, which you have to be if you're going to represent Michigan in Congress. But I suspect that our next U.S. senator, at least for a while, is going to be a little bit more Midwest-centric than the senior senator from Michigan.
Okay, well, let's talk about the candidates. And first, the Republican Terry Lindland, formerly Michigan's Secretary of State. She also served on the Republican National Committee. Let's listen to her here in a recent ad where she brings up the fact that she is a mother.
Congressman Peters says a mom like me isn't up to the job, but moms like me get things done. Let's secure the border, repeal Obamacare, and get equal pay for equal work for men and women.
Okay, so she is a mom, and she's also
talking
about a lot of things there that we've heard from Republican candidates across the country, secure the border, repeal Obamacare. But tell us more about Terry Lindland.
What Terry Lindland is trying to do is sort of jujitsu something that was kind of a pratfall on her part. She was appearing, in fact, it was on a statewide public radio call-in show, and when she was asked about a whole host of issues, she just sort of reverted to this theme that she's a mom, she has two kids. It became a bit of an internet meme, and some of the people who were playing along were people who worked for the Gary Peters campaign. And so, like I said, she tried to jujitsu that and kind of accused Gary Peters of running a, quote, anti-mom campaign, which he says he is not anti-mom.
Well, and her opponent, Gary Peters, also recently released an ad that was talking about family. It featured his family. Let's listen.
I'm Gary Peters, and my family sees my fiscal approach differently.
I wouldn't call them cheap, but our washing machine is older than the kids.
It still works.
Dad wears this sweatshirt everywhere.
It's comfy. The way I was brought up, you don't spend money you don't have.
Really, Dad?
I run my office.
I have to say, that's a little bit unusual coming from a Democrat to be making that case. You would think that would be a Republican ad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, a lot of Republican and Democratic pundits that I talked to, called that the best ad of this cycle in Michigan. He's doing a couple of things there, and one of them is just kind of, lightening up an image that where he can come off as kind of dense in an Al Gore-ish sort of way. But the other thing, too, is Gary Peters is trying to run as an independent candidate more than a Democratic candidate. So in some of the other ads, he talks about, places where he's broken with the Obama administration, even though he is certainly a Democrat in very, very good standing. And he will certainly be up there with President Obama when the president comes to visit Michigan on Saturday.
And we should note that Michigan has this governor's race as well. The incumbent Republican Governor Rick Snyder trying to keep his job. Is that expected to have an impact on the Senate race?
Well, it's kind of interesting that some Republicans were actually kind of nervous that Rick Snyder is not doing as well as they think that he ought to be in, you know, what's typically a Republican year. You know, what we see in Michigan, like, you know, a lot of Midwestern states, is that even though we're a blue state, it's a blue state that can very easily go red in the off-year elections if, as is often the case, Democrats don't turn out. And so what these Republicans would have liked to have seen is a stronger showing from Rick Snyder to maybe help boost the prospects of Terry Lynn Land and other Republicans further down on the ticket. The most recent polling, you know, shows that the governor is maybe starting to break away. The Real Clear Politics average of polls, I think, has him up by about 4 points. But if you look at the Senate race, that, you know, Gary Peters, by almost every poll at this point, has a double-digit lead over Terry Lynn Land in what's supposed to be kind of a Republican year.
I want to bring you back to what you were talking about at the beginning and Carl Levin and the fact that you have a senator from Michigan. Of course, they're going to be very supportive of the auto industry. Given all that has changed in Michigan over the last several years and the bankruptcy of some of the big automakers and then the rebound of some of the big automakers, is that going to be the case going forward, that the auto industry is the most important thing for the senator from Michigan?
Yes, yes, and yes. The auto industry is still the dominant industry in Michigan. And as a matter of fact, if you even look at the increase in small businesses in Michigan, and we have had that, a lot of them are built around some type of service to the auto industry. And so you really can't be a politician from Michigan and not have real fealty to the car business in the state. And, you know, it's still a litmus test in elections to ask candidates how they would have voted on the auto rescue package. And you really kind of have to answer yes. To do otherwise is to take your fate in your hands.
Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, talking with us about the Senate race there in Michigan. Rick, thank you.
Oh, great talking to you.
Well, at least $12 million has already been spent on TV ads trying to influence the outcome of judicial races in 10 states next Tuesday. Much of that money comes from special interest groups, and opponents of that say it means judgeships are up for sale like never before. On Tuesday, voters in Tennessee will consider a ballot question about their state's judicial elections. It's launched debate over what's the fairest way to select judges, and it comes after an August race that cost more than $2 million. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Bobby Allen of WPLN in Nashville reports.
In Tennessee, when there's an open seat on an appeals court, a committee recommends three candidates to the governor. The governor chooses one of them, and every 8 years, voters either re-elect or reject that judge at the polls. Nearly half the states use a system similar to this one. It's called a retention election, and it's designed to keep politics out of the judicial branch. Burt Brandenburg is the executive director of the nonpartisan group Justice at Stake.
So while retention elections are not a bulletproof shield, they are more of a deterrent than contested elections, which are simply essentially a wide-open invitation to interest groups to spend round the clock.
And that's the way it used to go in Tennessee. Judge races were largely ignored and free of outside money. That's until Republican activists saw an opportunity to spend a relatively small amount of money and have a big influence. Similar efforts have been underway in Montana, North Carolina, and Iowa. Though the effort failed in Tennessee, some say the campaign dollars were still meaningful. Shortly after the race, the justices appointed a Republican attorney general, which is exactly what the Republican activists were after. The lead activist, the lieutenant governor.
Justices capitulated to the lieutenant governor and validated what he was trying to do in politicizing the our state's judiciary.
Democrat Craig Fitchew is the House Minority Leader in the Tennessee legislature. Fitchew says the unusual August election turned judges into fundraisers, which is not what the Tennessee Constitution intended. Brandenburg of Justice at Stake agrees.
What Tennessee saw this year is the norm in places like Alabama, Mississippi, Illinois, Georgia, Michigan, Ohio.
In all of those states, upper court justices run in contested races, just like any other elected official. Critics say that opens the door to outside money. Proponents argue it gives people a direct say.
Judges shall be elected by the qualified voters of the state.
That's 84-year-old attorney John J. Hooker, who always carries a well-worn copy of the Tennessee Constitution with him in his back pocket. For more than 20 years, he's been suing state officials over the judge selection process. He even had his law license suspended once for jamming up the courts with so-called frivolous lawsuits.
That's my function, is to be a protester here in the twilight of my life to try to do something that's the right thing to do.
Hooker's main argument? Voters, not the governor, should be picking appeals judges. Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam wants to put an end to Hooker's attacks.
In recent years, there have been numerous, and I emphasize numerous, legal challenges to the way we select our appellate court judges in Tennessee. These continuing challenges and the confusion that they create threaten to destabilize and weaken our judiciary.
So the governor and business groups want to rewrite the Constitution so that the state could never go to a system where voters directly elect judges. John Crisp is the spokesman for the Vote Yes on Amendment 2 campaign.
They want those judges to be interpreting the Constitution and our laws and not susceptible to the influence of, you know, out-of-state campaign money that might have been used to select them.
The glib assertion that Amendment 2 is going to keep money out and keep politics out is ridiculous. We just had a demonstration by the sitting court that doesn't work.
John Avery Emison is fighting against Amendment 2. He says the fact that more than $2 million was spent on TV ads and campaigning on the three state Supreme Court seats shows that Tennessee's current arrangement is already politicized. But Vote Yes spokesman Crisp says think of what would happen if each one of the state's 29 appeals judges ran in regular elections.
You know, millions of more dollars spent on trying to influence the selection of those justices, including most likely a lot of out-of-state money flowing in to try to help represent one interest or the other. That's been the experience that we've seen in other states.
Here's the most ironic thing about Amendment 2. If voters do say no, well, nothing changes. The current system of governor-appointed judges, condemned by opponents as unfair, stays. But the door will be left open to lawsuits and legislation seeking to change Tennessee to a state where voters directly elect judges. For Here and Now, I'm Bobby Allen in Nashville.
So that's one ballot measure. There are 146 ballot questions on statewide ballots in 42 states next Tuesday, topics from abortion to voting rights. You're listening to Here and Now.
Nurse Casey Hickox went for a bike ride today in Maine. State police followed, and a lot of reporters were there to greet her at the end of the ride.
Pretty bold of you to go out on a bike ride while the state police are here.
Casey,
why?
There's no legal action against me, so I'm free to go on a bike ride in my hometown.
Hickox is the nurse who is supposed to be under quarantine because of her work in Sierra Leone with Ebola patients. She says she's fine and has tested negative for Ebola. The state could try to force Hickox to remain housebound until her 21-day incubation period ends November 10th. But to the scientists who are monitoring the outbreak of Ebola around the world, it's not a potential case in the U.S. that is so scary. It's the idea of a case in the developing world, India, China, or other countries in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Experts at the Laboratory for the Modeling of Biological and Socio-Technical Systems at Northeastern University have developed a computer model designed to predict the path of Ebola based on everything from demographics to travel patterns. Alessandro Vespignani is leading the research. He's a computer and health science professor at Northeastern. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how do you know where Ebola is headed next?
Well, what we do is to build very large-scale computational models for the evolution of the epidemic. So this is a little bit like doing weather forecasts. You have, you know, a big computational model where you try to integrate all the data of the epidemic. Obviously, instead of weather data, we use data on population, the number of cases, the epidemic parameters. And, you know, the models will project what happens in the next month, 2 months.
So what are your models telling you?
Well, for the moment, you know, the big issue is the fight that we are, you know, having in West Africa. So this is where we still see a lot of cases, although we got some positive, some positive news from the WHO that there is a little bit of slowing down of cases in Liberia. That was the hardest hit country. But, you know, this is where we have basically now the majority of cases. And we have, you know, probability of importation in other country. So there is a potential for international spread, as we have seen in the United States. There are other countries in Europe and obviously in Africa that are the most worrisome, because it's where the, how to say, those little sparks could trigger another fire.
And you found that in Asia, China is most at risk of having an Ebola outbreak.
Well, this is the place where there is the big question mark. You know, at the moment, they don't have a large probability of importing cases from that from West Africa region. But of course, if we are not able to put under control the outbreak, this probability is going to increase. And especially if we have spillover in other African countries with tighter relations to Asia, we could find cases in Asia. And then what happens if we have, a few sparks in India or China, will be those healthcare systems able to cope with those cases?
And these are very crowded countries in some places.
More than one-third of the world population is
right
there. And, I'm sure that, some of the places, like the big cities, have very good healthcare that should be able to cope with an eventual importation of an Ebola case. But, other rural areas, and especially, those are countries affected by other diseases, that can be, not natural to have immediately an Ebola diagnosis there. So, there are a lot of question marks.
You mean that they wouldn't figure it out right away that it was Ebola?
Yeah, that's one of the risks, mm-hmm. And, obviously there is the history of the patient and as it traveled to one of the countries affected at the moment by Ebola. But you never know what could be the response. And we have seen that it's possible to make mistakes. So, all countries, the more we have those little sparks going around the world, and the more is the risk that we have other fires. And that's what we should be worried at the moment, really, to put down the fire in West Africa so that this is the insurance policy for the world.
The other thing that comes to mind is, if there is an Ebola case in China, would we know about it? That government has not been transparent on a number of things.
Well, that we had experience like the SARS epidemic, yeah, in 2002. The communication were not so good. Recent experiences have been much better. For instance, with H7N9, the new avian influenza in the past year. So, probably China would communicate. And obviously, now there is a lot of awareness in all countries about Ebola, and so that's probably will help. But of course, if we have multiple ignition, multiple sparks, any kind of system would be having trouble in coping with those.
Why do you think that the U.S. got a case of Ebola before China or India?
Well, you just look at the traffic flow of people from that area to other countries. And the United States is one of the countries that has a reasonable amount of traffic
flow. Well, so does Europe, though, right?
And does Europe. So indeed, actually, the other countries which are at risk are UK, not all Europe. So United Kingdom, France, Belgium. India and China do not have too many relations with that area of Africa, but they have with other countries in Africa, and that's one of the, you can imagine this kind of chain reaction in which, there is a spillover in other countries in Africa, and then from there in Asia or other places in Europe or U.S., South, Latin America.
As you look at your data and you look at where Ebola might go next, what do you think of these people who are saying, let's cut off flights to the affected countries?
Well, one good thing to tell people is that even right now, at this very moment, the traffic to and from the region is probably just 20% of what it was before Ebola. Mm. People do not travel there, and all the travel have been reduced. We can do better. We can probably push to 90, 95%. But this is just slowing down of a few weeks what would be the case importation. So this is not something that we can use to be safe. We cannot seal off the world. That's the point. And the only way really we, on the long run, we can be safe from Ebola is to win the outbreak in West Africa.
What is the most frightening thing that you have found? What's a worst-case scenario? Which country would you be most worried about getting Ebola because they just don't have the capacity to handle it?
Well, for instance, we have one case in Mali at the moment. It's one country nearby the affected region, and it's not given that they will be able to control the outbreak. So I hope that. But, you know, that could be another fire, and that fire could move to another place and so on and so forth. So it's not just a specific country. It's the idea that you get sparks that could start those fires, and each fire is a problem by itself that requires international intervention and a lot of capacity on the ground. So, you know, the worst-case scenario is that we are not able to control the outbreak, and this acquires what we call pandemic potential. So really, the possibility of traveling, you know, internationally in many, many different places, in many continents, and then it would be a totally different story.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that it's a much bigger problem if it's in a place like Mali or in a place that's rural than if it were to show up in a very densely populated city that also has very high-end medical abilities.
You know, if it shows up, what we always say, you know, I'm more worried about one case in Mali or one case in Ghana than one case in London or one case in New York, because, you know, our healthcare system should be able to cope with it. You know, obviously you can see transmission locally. You can have one or two cases in the household healthcare workers, but obviously we are able to contain an outbreak. In those countries, you don't know what is going to happen.
Alessandro Vespignani, a computer and health sciences professor at Northeastern University who's been doing research on where Ebola may go next. Alessandro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pack your bags. The budget carrier WOW Air is offering service from the U.S. to Europe for less than $250 round trip. Let me repeat that. Less than $250 round trip. Discount airlines have been luring customers from the legacy carriers with cheap fares and bare-bones service, but the Iceland-based WOW Air is stretching these limits by offering these discounted international flights. Derek Thompson is senior business editor for The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Derek, tell us more. How do they do this? What is WOW Air's plan?
WOW Air's plan is exciting a lot of people right now. So essentially, they're thinking about planning on offering $99 flights from Boston, Baltimore to Reykjavik, Iceland. It should be said that Reykjavik is actually closer to the east coast of the United States than some flights to southwest U.S. So I actually just went to Reykjavik for a trip. Weirdly enough, a few weeks ago, it's only 5 hours. So this international flight is one of the cheapest, even one of the shortest you can possibly take to Europe. But $99 is a pretty astonishing figure for people looking to fly abroad.
Well, Derek, I have to ask, what did you pay when you went?
Did I pay?
Yeah.
I actually don't know. I don't quite recall what I paid because it was for a trip for another company. But I think I did see the price on a receipt that was emailed to me, and I believe it was around $500 or $600.
So there you go. It wasn't
$99.
Right. Well, WOW Air, I must say, I don't think I know of it. Is this relatively unknown?
It is. It's 3 years old. It's a discount air carrier. There's a lot of these discount air carriers that you're seeing going around. You know, it should be said that this is a part of a much broader trend, which is that airline ticket prices, real inflation-adjusted airline ticket prices, have actually fallen 50% in the last 30 years. This used to be a highly, highly regulated industry that was deregulated in the 1970s, at least in the U.S., which led to a lot of other deregulation throughout the rest of the industrial world. And so you've seen prices come down really dramatically, not only because of this deregulation, but also because think about the way that people shop for airline tickets. You don't necessarily shop for a brand. You go onto something like Kayak and you look for the very cheapest things. There's this race to the bottom.
Yeah.
You have these companies like Spirit and Southwest, now WOW, trying to find ways to get that actual ticket price as far down as possible.
Well, but, you know, Jeremy has been pointing out that the cost of taxes and fees alone for international air travel, and if you haven't done it lately, it's really been so high, that is usually more than these fares are. So how else can WOW keep these prices so low?
WOW is keeping these prices low because what they're selling is not what people typically consider the entire experience of flying. What they're selling is basically a cheap seat inside of a metal container. If you want a carry-on, that's going to cost you extra. If you book online, I believe it costs you extra. If you check luggage, which strikes me as extremely likely if you're flying overseas, most people don't take 24-hour trips to Spain from the East Coast, that's also going to cost you extra. And so what you're doing is you're packing in a lot of people onto a cheap metal container and flying them across for very little money and then charging them extra for everything else they do. Yeah. There was this joke that Spirit Airlines was considering charging people for going to the bathroom. I do believe that was an April 1st joke, but that's the kind of way that these companies potentially make up the money that they're losing on the actual ticket price right. that you see on something like kayaks.com.
Well, we did a search, and many of the flights next spring, for instance, from Boston to London, are sold out. So it's selling. Derek Thompson, a business editor for The Atlantic on WOW Airlines out of Iceland. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, North Korea declared it would quarantine foreigners for 21 days because of Ebola fears. And earlier this week, a crew dressed in full hazmat gear greeted Japanese government officials arriving at the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, in hazmat suits. Odd, since North Korea is so isolated and authorities have been trying to increase tourism. Eric Talmadge is Pyongyang bureau chief for the AP. He recently got permission for a road trip outside of the capital, and we want to hear about that. But Eric, you're in Tokyo now, so you got out of North Korea before this quarantine. But hazmat suits, really? Officials there, are that afraid?
Well, yeah, it was really quite surprising. When the Japanese delegation came, it was a government delegation. It was a very high-level delegation. And when we were waiting for them to come out of the terminal, we noticed there was an ambulance parked in the parking lot and two men in full hazmat suits waiting for the delegation to come out. Now, that was a big surprise for me when I saw that. I'd never seen anything like that at the airport. And, in fact, I think it might be the first time I've ever even seen an ambulance in Pyongyang.
Well, this is happening as the country is looking for tourists and visitors to come. So you were granted this unprecedented trip to go see some of the new tourist places that are set up. Does North Korea really think that there will be an influx of tourists when they've imprisoned Americans who came to the country? I mean, it doesn't seem very welcoming.
Well, you have to think of it more on the North Korean terms and what their priorities are. What they're hoping to do mostly is to increase the number of tourists coming from China. Of course, they are trying to increase tourists from Europe and from the United States and from other places. Of course, when you're looking at it from the American perspective, where you have tourists being arrested for alleged crimes and the various restrictions that are still in place on foreigners traveling to the North, it does seem rather contradictory.
Yeah. Well, tell us about what the country wants them to see. You write about leaving Pyongyang with, you know, more sophisticated dressed women clutching smartphones which aren't connected to the web and can't make or receive international calls, but there's more of a sophistication. And you make your way out into the country where passenger cars are so rare that when you passed police, they assumed you were important and saluted you. Tell us a little bit about what you saw out in the country.
When you leave the city, it's almost immediate, the change. You go into a very rural setting very quickly. The road situations they're much more bumpy. It's a bumpier ride. And then, of course, when you get farther into the inland, you're more on dirt roads or partially paved roads. And Pyongyang, I think this is surprising to many people, but Pyongyang is actually a fairly impressive city. It's particularly by developing world standards. It's full of high-rise buildings. There's many monuments. It's quite orderly, quite clean. And when you get out into the countryside, you're getting more of a view of the rural lifestyle where people are working very hard on the farms. North Korea is a very mountainous country, so producing enough food to feed all of the nation is an eternal challenge. They're working every possible piece of land to try to produce something out of it.
You describe villagers washing clothes in rivers, everybody wearing the same sort of olive green work suit with rubber boots. And describe the posters that you see.
One of the things that struck me as really singular about the North Korean countryside is when you're driving through the country, you're just constantly seeing signs with slogans from the party. One of the most popular is single-minded unity, which is kind of the motto of the North Korean government. And then things like, we are a great spacefaring nation, long live the military first policy. And then a lot of signs kind of hailing workers who have achieved their quotas.
Here's one you saw. Congratulations to Chungyong Tu, head of Work Unit 1, for taking the lead in weeding our fields.
Yes. And then posters with graphs showing, you know, what percentage of their expected yield they'd actually achieved. And the graphs seem to always go in an upward line.
Well, it's funny. I was chuckling over one of my favorites that you saw. Our country is the best. And then I thought, well, you know, you could drive across the U.S. and see U.S. number one. You know, you could see those things here.
Yeah.
But this is obviously so different. You write about every home, and we knew this, has a picture of the Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il in the home. And every adult wears a picture over their heart. But tell us about this new idea of building these tourist areas. What are they?
Well, there's a number of tourist areas. I mean, North Korea has experimented with the idea of increasing the tourist trade for quite a long time, actually. A lot of the places that they try to bring tourists to are natural attractions. Like I said, North Korea is a very mountainous country, and the mountain scenery is actually quite beautiful. It's largely untouched. The seasons are very well defined, so the autumn is quite beautiful. There's some very nice beaches in North Korea, and actually from this year they opened up a new luxury ski resort. I've actually been there and skied, and it was a very nice resort.
Well, on this road trip, you go to Mount Paektu, which has a beautiful crater lake, one of the places the North wants to promote. But, you know, you talk about your hotel room, cold shower and a broiling hot room. And you see people across the way in an apartment building, they have no electricity or don't seem to.
Right. Your room would be fine. You'd have heat, you'd have power, you'd even have a television that would work, but you could look across the street into almost complete darkness. And sometimes the lights would just suddenly come on later, and you'd see the apartment next door is, you know, lit up quite brightly. So it's quite a contrast.
Yeah. But you also write that during a hike late at night, you got to feel what satellite images have shown, how dark North Korea can be.
Right. That was one of the more impressive things for us. When we were very close to Mount Paektu, we went before dawn because we wanted to see the sunrise on the top of the mountain. You know, driving up the side of a mountain and it's pitch black. It was raining very hard, actually. And the feeling of being in that darkness where the only light is the headlights of your own car, it's something that you feel kind of viscerally, just the darkness of the night.
Yeah. Metaphor, you know, for the darkness and reclusiveness of the country. And you had Wranglers the whole time. You had a pit stop at one point. You were right near North Koreans, but they don't make eye contact with you. They're not allowed. So it's not like you're going to have that kind of a cultural experience. But I'm wondering, do you think that people should consider whether or not they want to support a repressive regime? Wouldn't you be doing that if you took one of these trips?
Well, I think it's up to each person. You know, giving the North Koreans the opportunity to see us is also, you know, there could be some benefit in that as well.
Yeah. That's Eric Talmadge, Pyongyang bureau chief for the Associated Press in North Korea, telling us about fascinating insight he has into the country. Eric, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, question for you. Would you want to go? Do you feel you'd be influencing North Koreans who might see you or supporting the regime that represses them if you take a tourist trip to North Korea? Let us know at hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now, and Halloween is tomorrow, so we want to check in with NPR's Petra Mayer about some frightening books to get you in the mood. Welcome, Petra.
Hi, nice to be here.
And tell us first what makes a terrifying book terrifying.
Well, first, I hope you appreciate what I went through to do this segment, because I'm a giant horror wuss, and so I have been scaring the bejesus out of myself for the past few days. But it's a good question, because, you know, what scares you is not what scares me, which is everything. Fear is simple, though. I think that's the heart of it, right? Figuring out what you're afraid of and why you're afraid of it, that's complicated, and that's why we have therapists. But fear is really simple. It's really primal. Like, if you pick apart, you know, the massive books of Stephen King, you know, right at the core, there are these simple, simple fears, fears of the dark or of growing up or of the unknown or loss or being trapped. So I think simplicity is at the heart of the best horror stories. In fact, there's a thread right now on Reddit, two sentence horror stories. And the best one, the most popular one now, I will read it to you. I have it here.
Okay.
It's by a user called Juan Ruiz. It goes like this. I begin tucking him into bed, and he tells me, "Daddy, check for monsters under my bed." I look underneath for his amusement, and I see him, another him, under the bed, staring back at me and quivering and whispering, "Daddy, there's someone on my bed."
Now, okay, having heard that, I have to ask you, how different is the fear from the scariest of scary books than the fear that when you watch a scary movie?
Oh, interesting. I think it might be the same fear, although with the movie, you kind of, you're drawn along no matter what, right? You can't look away.
Right.
With a book, you can put it down, you can take a break, you can read something else for a while, but you're in there in the movie theater, and unless you, like, you know, hide your eyes and block your ears, you're going to be experiencing it no matter what. It's like being on a roller coaster.
Right. Okay. Well, tell us what your first pick of a book is for a good scary read for people to get into the Halloween spirit.
Well, I think my first pick is one that a lot of people out there might remember and might have been scarred by as children. It's called Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which these were big in the 80s. Maybe you found them in your local library, or maybe somebody gave you one. They're compiled by Alvin Schwartz, who is a folklorist, and a lot of them are kind of the classic urban legends that we all creeped each other out with, you know, like the girl driving along the dark highway with the high beams, or the bride who gets locked in the trunk, or spider eggs in your face, sort of just creepy, disgusting stuff like that. The stories themselves kind of are a little spare on the page. They depend on being read aloud for their power. But the illustrations, now I'm talking here about the original illustrations, the 80s versions, they are absolutely soul-scarring. They're by an artist named Stephen Gammell, and I think a generation of kids, including me, were really traumatized by them. They're these blotchy, drippy, misty, black and white, eerie, ghouly. They look like you should be finding them in like the VHS horror section of your local video store, assuming such a thing still exists, right? Mm. There's nothing for kids about them. And in fact, the Scary Stories books are some of the most challenged books of the past 20 years because people are so scared of these illustrations. So when HarperCollins was putting out an omnibus edition a few years ago, an anniversary edition, they swapped them out for new, less scary illustrations, and everybody lost it. They were like, no, bring back the original ones.
You know, I vaguely remember this book, although I think I have blocked out the details from my memory because I would much rather just read something funny and be in a good mood than read something scary and get scared. But at least I was at that age. But tell us another one, Petra. What's another recommendation?
Well, I want to keep with the theme of creepy artwork a little longer. I want to tell you about a graphic novel called Through the Woods by a Canadian artist named Emily Carroll, which is a collection of five absolutely, I'm like shivering just recalling reading these stories. Mm. They're all kind of, she wrote them, but they all have kind of classic elements of fairy tale, like Bluebeard and Red Riding Hood. They all have that feeling once you've read them that this was probably true, that this probably happened somewhere. She starts the book with this short sequence about how she loved to read scary stories as a kid, and it's beautifully illustrated, you know, her on her little bed in the pool of lamplight, and then what would happen if she reached out into the dark and something took her hand. And the whole book, it just, her use of color is really amazing, the way she plays off these bright, rich colors against creepy narratives. You just feel so uneasy when you open the book and there's this beautiful spread of like an eerie kind of winter woods scene with an ominous red sun and a little cloaked figure hurrying along. It's and the lettering also, in any good graphic novel, really the lettering works with the imagery. And her lettering is just kind of spidery and shivery, and it wanders all over the page. And it is almost that sense of being drawn along like a roller coaster. When I was reading the book, there were parts of it where I really wanted to look away, and I actually couldn't.
Well, give us a passage from it.
Yeah, sure. This is the opening passage of a story called His Face All Red. This man is not my brother. My brother has a cottage with a hawthorn tree and a lilac bush, and a plump young wife with starry eyes. My brother has a fine coat and a vest the color of moss, and a way with people that makes them trust him. This man has all these things, and my brother's face, his handsome face. But just last week, I killed my brother.
All right. Well, we have time for just one more. Petra, what's it going to be?
This is going to be a classic, The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson.
Okay.
a book you should definitely not read before bed. It's one of the best ghost stories ever written. Even Stephen King thinks so. And it's been made into a couple of movies, but the book is really just the best. It's a classic haunted house setup. There's a creepy Victorian house on a hill. There are four people who are there to study ghosts and paranormal phenomena. And they're going to document whatever's going on there, right? So it's this very spooky setting. It's in these ominous, oppressive hills. There's a creepy caretaker. But what's so scary about it is not the ghost, if there even is one, because you're never really sure when you're reading it. It could just be some kind of psychological manifestation. What's really creepy about it is the psychological aspects, the fact that Eleanor, the narrator, is sort of pretty much the definition of unreliable. You know right away that she's very dreamy and that she's given to these flights of fantasy. And as the book goes along and the house sort of starts to get into her head and her internal monologue gets more and more discordant, it is just so unbelievably creepy. And I wasn't kidding when I said don't read this before bed, because I did. Mm. And I'm the kind of person that wakes up a lot during the night. So I kept waking up in the dregs of some weird dream and going, oh, it's not me, it's the house. No, wait. So yeah, really
well,
scary.
It's you're safe here in either the middle of the day or the morning, depending on where in the country people are listening to this. So just give us a little passage from this.
Right. There are no ghosts in historic Studio 43. I should be safe. So this is a passage where Eleanor is in bed at night with her roommate, Theodora. They're sharing a room because Theodora's room has been trashed by a poltergeist. And Eleanor wakes up and she thinks she's hearing some child wailing and crying in the distance. Now, Eleanor thought, perceiving that she was lying sideways on the bed in the black darkness, holding with both hands to Theodora's hand, holding so tight that she could feel the fine bones of Theodora's fingers. Now, I will not endure this. They think to scare me. Well, they have. I'm scared. But more than that, I am a person. I am human. I am a walking, reasoning, humorous human being, and I will take a lot from this lunatic, filthy house, but I will not go along with hurting a child. No, I will not. I will, by God, get my mouth to open right now, and I will yell, I will yell, I will stop it, she shouted, and the lights were on the way they'd left them, and Theodora was sitting up in bed, startled and disheveled. What? Theodora was saying. What, now, what? Good God, Eleanor said, flinging herself out of bed and across the room to stand shuddering in a corner. Good God. Whose hand was I holding?
Petra Mayer trying to petrify us. Petra, See? This is the one time
there.
I can use that at NPR Books in Washington. Petra, thanks so much. Happy Halloween.
You too, and sleep well tonight.
I will try. And we've got Petra's picks at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Scaramy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.